Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeff Charlotte, a professor of English at Dartmouth College and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and Esquire, and the best-selling author or editor of 6 books of literary journalism, including The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Charlotte.
Hi, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And what do you make of the appearance in an orange jumpsuit today of Maria Butina in a federal court in Washington, D.C.? She's considered a flight risk. She's being held in jail. She's being charged essentially with being a Russian spy and illegally operating as a foreign agent in this country. She apparently infiltrated or tried to infiltrate the highest levels of the NRA, but also the prayer breakfast, the secretive group that run that, the fellowship, or as you've written about, the family. So why are the Russians interested in the family?
Quite simply, it's the quickest and most efficient backdoor to American power. The family, unlike other Christian right groups that sort of lobby for access to Washington power, the family is comprised of and dedicated to insiders. It's not for the folks out in the heartland expressing their values. It's senators, congressmen, military leaders, business leaders. And so if you are looking for influence in Washington, there is possibly no better religious channel than this organization.
Well, in the 17-page affidavit released on Monday by the DOJ, outlining their charges against Maria Butina, it references her dealings with organizers of the National Prayer Breakfast and also the fact that they have this conservative Christian organization have been sending conservative Christian congressmen on multiple trips to Eastern European countries friendly with Russia. She apparently attended at least 2 of these prayer breakfasts and even invited Vladimir Putin to one in February of 2017. He didn't say no, but he didn't show up.
So. Well, it goes deeper than that. She attended more than 2, but she also attends the Moscow prayer breakfast, which is a direct offshoot of the National Prayer Breakfast. It was founded in 1992 by Doug Burleigh, who was the current leader of the family, the National Prayer Breakfast organizer. And in fact, that's where she first met the unidentified person number 2, or at least we know that the first meeting that we know of with an unidentified person number 2 in the affidavit. So this relationship with this organization goes much deeper both ways. I think what's notable is that we're concentrating on Russians infiltrating this organization, and that to me presents a more innocent, naive reading of what the family is. It's worth noting that they are reaching out to her, too. Not only does she attend their events in Moscow, but they actually travel to Moscow to meet with her and her
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Stoller, who's a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, who is currently writing a book on monopoly power in the 20th century. Previously, he spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where he focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. In addition to his work on the Hill, he's produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell Brand. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Stoller.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Matt, it's almost as though the Europeans are shaming us in terms of dealing with these enormous tech monopolies that are growing in power at an extraordinary rate. I mean, 10 years ago, the number one corporation in the world, I think, was ExxonMobil, and now it's Alphabet, Google, and all the other tech companies, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, are close behind. So is it right to assume that in maybe another 10 years, they'll be even, 10 times more powerful than they are now?
Well, you know, if you had asked me a couple of years ago if Donald Trump would be president, I would have thought it was sort of foolish, crazy. So I'm not very good at predicting the future, but they're really powerful. And I think we're going to deal with them. But if we don't, in 10 years, this will be a very different society.
So specifically, the fine levied by the Europeans against Google is $5.1 billion for abusing their power in the mobile phone market. So why them and not Apple, for example? I thought Apple had a bigger penetration of the market than Android.
So the specific problem that the European Competition Commission was looking at was not Google having a large market share in the mobile phone market, which it does through its ownership of the Android mobile operating system. It said it was using its market share of the mobile licensed mobile operating system to entrench dominance in an anti-competitive manner of its search engine. So it's a tying or bundling case, which is to say it's saying one product, if you buy one product, you're going to be forced to take a different product. So it's not like Apple where they're just selling their phones. You're actually talking about Google giving away an operating system, but forcing the phone makers that use that operating system to also pre-install Google Search.
And I guess that's the sort of portal that gives them so much power, doesn't it? Isn't that essentially dominating the global market, Google Search?
Yeah, that's right. So Google is trying to maintain its dominance in the search market, and it's doing it by paying off telecom companies and also contractual restrictions on phone makers and so on and so forth. That's what the fine was for.
But aren't they also paying off politicians here in the United States, not to put too fine a point on it?
Yeah, I mean, they're doing it in both the U.S. and in Europe. And the Google has, a $300 million grant program for civil society groups, journalists or something in Europe. They give up, you know, they're the biggest lobbying firm in D.C. They, you know, they do, they give huge amounts to academics. So, yeah, I mean, they are a corrupting force, but this is not new, but it's on a pretty significant scale.
And is their motto still "Don't do evil"?
I don't know. maybe in sarcastic air quotes or something.
Right.
The problem isn't that. The problem is the legal context of the institution, right? I mean, their search engine is fine. A lot of their products are fine. The problem is that they're engaged in anti-competitive behavior to thwart any kind of competition. And that's really a function of a failure of policy. It's a failure of enforcement of the law, a failure of enforcement of regulations that should keep our markets open and competitive and keep institutions like Google in check.
So in terms of lobbying, and this applies to all of these tech companies, I mean, we know that Eric Schmidt, I think, visited the Obama White House more than any other single individual. What's happening under Trump? Are they still just as aggressive in terms of lobbying?
Of course. I mean, they have more money and power than they did. But, the problem that they are facing now is that they've lost their mystique. And this is true of Facebook, Amazon, and Google. Before the Trump election in 2016, before that, these institutions were seen as tech companies. They were kind of sorcerers. They had magic. They were cool. And after 2016, 2017, 2018, we've seen, you know, the Russia backdoor, the exploitation of these platforms. They didn't even know what was going on. A lot of these people supported Hillary Clinton, and it turns out that their magic didn't work. So there's been a puncturing of the bubble, even though they have more wealth and today than they did a couple of years ago. They've lost the mystique and they've lost that sense that they are doing good things for the world. Now they're just very powerful institutions.
So let's talk about the possibility of real antitrust. The Europeans are showing the way. Senator Blumenthal and other Democratic senators are also calling for the FTC to step up to the plate. What's your sense of where we stand over here in terms of antitrust activity?
Well, there was a judicial committee hearing yesterday on the House side, and there was an Energy and Commerce Committee hearing today on the House side. And everyone on both sides of the aisle seemed pretty mad at Facebook. And so, you know, if you take the press, a lot of the tech press kind of doesn't understand Congress. They think that they're stupid or ill-informed. But in fact, you know, if you listen to what they're saying, they're Chairman Goodlatte of the Judiciary Committee, who's a right-wing Republican, immediately started talking about how Facebook has no competition and that that's the big problem here. And, you know, you see this Adam Kinzinger today talked about competition, a problem of lack of competition in the economy more broadly. And so you see this, you know, both Republicans and Democrats are frustrated. They're particularly frustrated at the tech companies. So the policymakers have flipped pretty dramatically. The enforcers and the courts, however, on both sides of the aisle, the Democratic and Republican enforcers and courts, are much more skeptical of actually attacking these concentrations of power. But, you know, I think people misunderstand where the policy world is here. There, you know, there's like a pervasive sense of hopelessness, like nothing can be done. But if you actually just listen to what members of Congress are saying, you know, they're pretty much there. They understand the problem. And I think we're going to address this. We're going to address these concentrations of power fairly soon.
But there does seem to be a kind of political double standard in terms of the way that the Trump administration pursues antitrust. They're really going relentlessly after the AT&T Time Warner merger, because apparently, of course, Trump hates CNN. But other mergers, like the one involving Disney and Murdoch, seem to have the White House's blessing. So do you see a double standard there?
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, I'm not willing to say that they went after AT&T just because of CNN. I do think there was a good case there. But yeah, I mean, we have, you know, and you go back to the Obama administration even further, we have a really serious crisis with the rule of law, where law is now used as an arbitrary tool to wield power. And that's something that is incredibly dangerous. And it is a problem that's about 15 years old. And we have a crisis of legitimacy. So even legitimate attempts to constrain power, like the AT&T Time Warner merger, you know, there's a lot of reason, there's a lot of cynicism and skepticism, and I think for good reason. So this is a broader problem. It's a crisis of legitimacy. But we didn't send any Wall Street guys to jail. I mean, how can anybody have faith in our justice system? But we have to restore it, or we won't have a democracy for very much longer. I mean, that's really what we're talking about.
So where is Teddy Roosevelt when you need him?
Oh, Teddy Roosevelt is a fraud. He's a lot like Trump, actually. I mean, I know people love him, but, like, he was not a trustbuster. He didn't like antitrust. Sorry, I'm studying this stuff.
Right.
We have a history of going down very dark paths and then getting ourselves out. So this is not the first time America's been in really serious trouble. And we can get out of this. We really can.
Well, then let me rephrase that, since Teddy Roosevelt, his reputation doesn't deserve such accolades. What about Ida Tarbell and Mark Twain and others? Is that what we need? More exposure of these big barons and their power?
Well, really what we need to do is, you know, we need to understand our history. So Americans understand that there was a civil war to deal with slavery. But what they don't understand anymore, because it's been written out of history, is that we effectively had kind of a second civil war, but this one was peaceful, really from the in really the 1930s, from the 19-teens to the 1930s, to take down the second group of, I think one could call them masters or slave owners. This was Wall Street. This was the J.P. Morgan world. And these were really dangerous people who were doing very reckless things. And we did take them down and restructure the economy and restore justice. And that's the tradition that we have to get back to. The problem that people have today is that they don't understand that these concentrations of power are as dangerous as anything that we've ever seen in our political economy. And they are, in fact, deeply, deeply antithetical to American traditions. And we have to, through our politics, take back our liberty as citizens. That's the tradition that's missing, and that's what's coming back. And as you know, these tech platforms we're seeing, there's something weird about them, something dangerous, something autocratic that goes beyond just sort of weird technocratic pricing things. That's why you're seeing more skepticism. So we're on our way back. We're reclaiming these traditions, and as a people, we will restore our democracy. I'm pretty confident.
And in terms of the business model of surveillance capitalism, which arguably these big companies, Google and Facebook, operate on, do you think that consciousness is starting to seep into the broader public? In other words, the idea that you are the product, you may think you're getting something for free, but actually you're being monetized and you're not getting anything out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think people are very uneasy with all of the surveillance. They are very uneasy more broadly with consumer culture. They understand that they are the playthings of powerful forces and they don't like it. At the same time, they like the, you know, I like being able to fly places. I don't particularly like American Airlines. It's kind of the same way people think about technology. They like being able to find all this cool information and shop for things conveniently. They're not particularly comfortable with the power wielded by these institutions, the political power. So I think, you know, it's complex, but I think people are pretty much there. It's just we need the politicians and the policymakers to begin to wield power again.
And in terms of the politics of power in Silicon Valley, the assumption that Silicon Valley, I guess because it's in a blue state, California, with the world's fifth largest economy, the assumption has always been that it's a fairly liberal, progressive place, or at least the titans are. But we have one Silicon Valley titan putting forth a ballot initiative here in California to split up the state into three states. And it's so cynical and so obvious. If you look at the way he's drawn the map, it will end up here in California with only two Democrats and four Republican senators, which is clearly the design. And, of course, once California is broken up, it loses its clout with Detroit, you know, for emission standards, et cetera. And then you've got – recently I learned that Elon Musk has been giving a ton of money to the House and the Tea Party caucus, and you've got Peter Thiel and stuff. So if you were to do a kind of aggregate, where would you say the Zuckerbergs and all these people are in terms of their politics?
Well, they're autocrats. I mean, these people, they see the world and they believe that they should rule. And that, you know, Zuckerberg is progressive in the sense that he thinks he knows what's good for people and he can structure the world to give them what they need, whether they will accept it or not. There's a sort of progressive element to this, which is sort of kind of what you find in a lot of the, you know, a lot of technocratic elitism. It's not all of progressivism. You know, there's a populist, you know, these guys don't really believe in democracy. But I think one of the problems that Democrats have is that they don't recognize that the problem that we're facing of autocracy actually exists within both parties. So a good chunk of the Democratic Party has this kind of weird libertarian strain that is autocratic, and so does the Republican Party. The people find it hard to see that in the Democratic Party, even though when you look at, say, blue states like California or cities like D.C. or New York, they are the most economically unequal places in the country. So there's an intellectual challenge that we have as a people. It's not just about, you know, red versus blue, Republican, Democrat. It's actually about whether we as a people can regain control of our leadership at every level and within both parties.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to turn to a recent article you wrote, Matt Stoller at BuzzFeed, "The Chinese-Style Digital Dystopia Isn't as Far Away as We Think." And obviously, there is a concern that Silicon Valley cutting-edge technology is being used by the Chinese to repress their people. And there is this phenomenon of social credit score system in China. So, well, first of all, is there any real principle involved here? Are they making a stand against the abuse of technology, surveillance technology in China, for example, or are we going to head the way of China?
Well, so in China, what's happened is the government and private institutions are kind of combining all of the data that they have on people, and then they are making it, they are arranging their pricing algorithms and choices so that if you get placed on certain lists, then you have a harder time, say, buying train tickets or plane tickets, or they're reshaping everything that you see in your digital world based on their political values. It's like you get a credit score here. In China, they take your credit score, but they combine it with everything you say and do and everywhere you go, and then they offer you pricing choices and economic options and opportunities based on what, you know, the score that they get around you with no restrictions. And it's a really scary totalitarian type of system. And a lot of our Silicon Valley kind of oligarchs are really enthralled with that. They think it's incredibly innovative. They see that, well, there's no real restrictions on silly privacy restrictions or kind of old fuddy-duddy fashion rules that prevent us from innovating. And so you're seeing, you know, tremendous interest in Silicon Valley around what China is doing. And then you're also seeing a lot of the lobbying around preventing privacy rules, preventing facial recognition regulation. And some a lot of the mergers here are designed to basically replicate the storehouses of data and the ability to manipulate people with that data. It's not as advanced as it is in China. It's certainly not connected to the government in the same way. And we live in a democracy. We have a democratic culture. We're a liberal democracy still. But where they want to take us is towards that sort of creepy totalitarian world, which they wouldn't describe as such. They describe it as kind of, they'd have all these economic terms like revealed preferences and perfect pricing, price discrimination to describe it. But what they're effectively talking about is kind of this creepy totalitarian world where your options are presented to you based on this incredible invasive surveillance and these opaque algorithms.
And if you're in any way subversive, you're screwed, right? If you can't buy plane tickets and train tickets.
Well, right. That's how it works in China. I mean, that's an explicit political right. determination. But if you here, it would be the kind of thing like if you return an item to the store, you would get placed on a blacklist that says this person, you know, returns items to stores. And then when you walk into stores, the prices would maybe be higher for you than for other people. You know, that's the kind of thing that would happen. It would change. You wouldn't know that because you would just see the price that you see. But like your options, the world as you see it would differ completely based on your behavior. All of this stuff used to be illegal. It's not possible technically yet, but it's getting there.
Well, Matt Stoller, I thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Stoller, who's a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, who is currently working on a book on monopoly power in the 20th century. Previously, he spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where he focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. And in addition to his work on the Hill, he's produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell Brand. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.